What are the similarities between the founders of Islam and Mormonism? The Issues Etc. Book of the Month for April is The American Muhammad, Joseph Smith, Founder of Mormonism. It's written by regular guest Dr. Alvin Schmidt. You can purchase The American Muhammad by calling Concordia Publishing House 1-800-325-3040, or you can find out more at issuesetc.org. The American Muhammad, The Issues Etc. Book of the Month for April. They are the source of fascination for little children and for grown children alike. They are kind of mysterious. I don't know how many times in the course of a week they appear all over the Facebook. And apparently there's a new 3D edition of Jurassic Park out, this fantasy about dinosaurs come to life here in the 21st century. Now, how much of what is presented to us by pop culture and by pop science and by the evolutionary model regarding the dinosaurs, if that's an apt name for these creatures, how much of it is actually true? I mean, the big stories are that it's millions, hundreds of millions of years, the giants roaming the Earth, and then an asteroid. End of story for the dinosaurs. We go on with the rest of evolutionary history. Is that simple scenario true as well? Joining us to conclude a 7-part series we've been doing with him on creation today, the dinosaurs, creation, and the flood, Dr. Joel Heck. He's professor of theology at Concordia University, Texas. He's author of the book In the Beginning, God, and he'll be one of the speakers at a conference July the 8th through the 10th at Concordia University, Wisconsin, titled The Heavens Declare What Astronomy Can Tell Us About Biblical Creation. Dr. Heck, welcome back.
Thank you for the welcome. It's good to be with you once more.
What is the biggest myth that is propagated, in particular, in service of evolution and that teaching about the dinosaurs?
I would say that the biggest myth is the idea that dinosaurs became extinct some 65 to 70 million years ago, that there are no dinosaurs today, and that any dinosaurs that existed have long since passed from existence and are no more.
So, in substitute for that myth, what's the truth on those points you just mentioned?
Well, I would say that the truth is that dinosaurs were made by God in Genesis 1. We hear about all the different creatures, land and air and sea creatures that God made, and include dinosaurs in them. That dinosaurs existed in the pre-flood world, and that Noah took two of every kind of animal, probably not every species, but every kind of animal, onto the ark. And most people don't know this, but the average size of a dinosaur is about the size of a sheep. Most people think of the Stegosaurus, the Brontosaurus, the Triceratops, and especially the T-Rex, and they think massive dinosaurs, and then they think, well, yeah, if Noah had to take dinosaurs on the ark, how is he going to manage with those massive dinosaurs that are meat-eating and the like? And yet, those are full-grown creatures, the ones that are pictured in the movies like Jurassic Park or written about in books, and juvenile dinosaurs would be much smaller, and certainly Noah would have wanted to take younger dinosaurs on board the ark so that they could reproduce after the end of the flood. So the average size of a dinosaur, about the size of a sheep.
Okay, what about the name that we use here? We're stuck with it, but is it itself misleading, dinosaur?
Yes, the word is a little bit misleading. The word dinosaur literally means terrible lizard. In fact, I would invite anybody to look it up in the Merriam-Webster's dictionary or some other dictionary. It simply means terrible lizard. So it's a term that was coined back in the 19th century. As far as we know, it was first used in 1841, invented by Sir Richard Owen, and has been used ever since, of course, but it's simply a word for a reptile. And another thing that most people don't know about reptiles is that they're the only animal that grows throughout its entire lifetime, so that if a reptile lives an exceedingly long time, it can become very, very large. And probably in the pre-flood and the post-flood world, those dinosaurs, those lizards, lived for an awfully long time and became very, very large and were referred to in some parts of literature as, believe it or not, as dragons.
So how do the subjects go together, the dinosaurs and the flood? You mentioned that if we take the biblical account at face value, and dinosaurs exist in the pre-flood world, that Noah's going to take some kind of them, not all, every variety, but some kind of them with him as instructed by God. What about the rest of them?
Well, he would have taken a representative sample from every one of the kinds, the biblical kind. The word min, M-I-N, is the word that seems to be somewhere between genus and species, and all the other dinosaurs that would have descended from them after the end of the flood, but that all of the representative types of dinosaurs would have been on the ark. And then rather than having to resort to one of the 16 different theories for the extinction of the dinosaurs, and you mentioned one of them in your introduction, which is certainly one of them, the asteroid that would have affected the atmosphere and somehow spread throughout the entire world and resulting in their extinction, the dinosaurs probably went extinct for two major reasons following the flood. One was the major changes in climate that happened when an ice age began, and also other climate changes besides that, massive amounts of rainfall following the flood also. And then the other thing was being hunted down by human beings, sometimes for food, sometimes for safety purposes. But the little wrinkle in that is the stories that if you look on websites, creation.com is one of the places where they have more than 8,500 articles, and type in a word like dinosaur or dragon or terrible lizard and read some of the articles that they have there. I know of one individual who has interviewed over 100 people who claim to have seen a dinosaur. And I'm guessing that some of our listening audience may think that this is kind of like Roswell, New Mexico, and UFOs, and sure, people saw dinosaurs, give me a break. But there are lots of pieces of evidence, and I can run through several of them in the rest of our interview today. Pieces of evidence, some in buildings that have been constructed, some in photographs, some in engravings, some in literature, even something like the Chinese zodiac, which has 12 animals in the zodiac, a dragon and 11 real animals. One could easily ask, why would the Chinese choose one mythical animal to go in their zodiac along with 11 real ones? Doesn't it make more sense to suggest that the Chinese had 12 animals that actually did exist and the so-called dragon was actually some form of a dinosaur?
Even laying those aside, would you say that there are dinosaurs kind of under our nose that we may be missing in today's creatures?
Maybe not under our nose, but in certain parts of the world, especially underwater and deep sections of the oceans. One possibility is the Loch Ness Monster in Scotland. Some think that it may have been a plesiosaurus, and the Loch Ness has a depth of 812 feet and a surface of 21.8 miles. It's 25 miles long, so there's a massive amount of water there in the highlands of Scotland, and there it's big enough for a significant water-dwelling dinosaur to live. Now, if that's not the case, that wouldn't really bother me. But there are lots of other pieces of information, and probably the most intriguing one is this 55,000 square mile swamp in the area of the Congo in Central Africa, most of which has never really been explored. In fact, there was an article that appeared in the New York Herald in 1910 by a guy by the name of Roy Mackel. And the article is entitled, "Is a Brontosaurus Roaming Africa's Wilds?" And then 38 years later, the Saturday Evening Post ran an article, January 3, 1948, entitled, There Could Be Dinosaurs. And these periodicals are talking about the potential for there being some dinosaurs that roam the wilds of that 55,000-acre piece of land in the middle of the Congo. And apparently there are some of the people that live there locally who have seen these creatures and are able to describe them to people that come in from the outside but are really scared of this massive beast. So it'd be fascinating to be able to go in on a safari of that sort, but I think I'll let somebody else do that instead of me going on that. That's a little bit beyond my area of interest, but it would be fascinating to hear about that and see something that people could bring back.
Is it possible that some of the descriptions, in particular Old Testament descriptions, the poetic ones, I'm thinking about the latter chapters of Job, might be describing not just an exaggeration of, say, a big fish or a crocodile, but actual remnants of dinosaur species?
Yes, I certainly think it is. In particular, in the 40th chapter of Job, Job says, look at the behemoth. That's in Job 40, verse 15, and God says, look at the behemoth which I made along with you, which feeds on grass like an ox. And he seems to be describing the largest of creatures so as to impress Job. And he goes on to say, what strength he has in his loins, what power in the muscles of his belly. And then in verse 17, even though the first couple of verses I just read may be described as an elephant, it sounds a little bit like an elephant. He goes on in verse 17 and he says, his tail sways like a cedar. So the elephant's tail might be compared to a lot of things, like a rope or something small and flimsy, but to compare an elephant's tail to a cedar tree, I think, is making a huge mistake. There's something a whole lot larger than an elephant that's envisioned there in Job chapter 40.
Dr. Joel Heck is our guest. We'll be right back. Talk more about dinosaurs' creation and the flood, concluding our 7-part series on creation. When someone asks you, what do you believe as a Christian, how do you respond? Do you have a confession of faith? I've written an article in the latest Issues Etc. Journal titled, I Believe. You can read it by subscribing to the Issues Etc. Journal. Just look for the subscription button in the right-hand column at issuesetc.org. In the Wittenberg Trail feature, Mark Hemingway answers the question, why Lutheranism with why not? Subscribe to the online Issues Etc. Journal, issuesetc.org.
Does your church need a backup organist? The virtual organist service from Church Music Solutions is the next best thing to an on-site organist. Send us your musical choices, including liturgy and hymns. We'll assemble your service and send it to an iPad that controls your church's organ on Sunday. The result is genuine organ leadership on your instrument with your selections when you need it. See our videos on YouTube or visit our website at churchmusicsolutions.com.
Providing artillery support for the church militant on the front lines, you're listening to Issues Etc.
Thanks to the following congregations for standing with us by joining the Issues Etc. 300. Messiah Lutheran, Seattle, Washington. Grace Lutheran, McPherson, Kansas. St. Paul's Lutheran, Bridgeport, Nebraska. Our Savior Lutheran, Raleigh, North Carolina. St. Paul Lutheran, Hancock, Maryland. Messiah Lutheran, Keller, Texas. St. John's Lutheran, Maple Grove, Minnesota. Grace Lutheran, Parker, Colorado. And Our Redeemer Lutheran, Harrington, Kansas. Find out how your church can support this worldwide outreach by including Issues Etc. in your mission or advertising budget. Go to our website, issuesetc.org, and click support. When your congregation joins the Issues Etc. 300, we'll advertise your congregation on the radio, at our website, and in the Issues Etc. journal. issuesetc.org, click support. The Issues Etc. 300. Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Every time we put out an Issues Etc. journal, we like to include a little feature called the Wittenberg Trail. It's usually reserved for those who have come to Reformation theology, to the Lutheran faith via some circuitous route. I can't think of one more circuitous than from not just Mormonism, but from kind of Jack Mormonism. Someone who was raised Mormon, didn't really care, didn't really believe much of what was taught there, to the Lutheran theology, to the Lutheran faith. And that's exactly the story of our latest Issues Etc. Journal Wittenberg Trail feature from Mark Hemingway, a senior writer for the Weekly Standard. He tells his story there. I've got an article in the latest edition of the journal as well called I Believe, about your confession of faith. You can subscribe to the Issues Etc. Journal absolutely free at our website, issuesetc.org. When you get there, there's a big red button right off to the side. Click on that, enter your email address, and you are subscribed to the Issues Etc. Journal. It also contains a list of all of the Issues Etc. 300 congregations, kind of a in-print find a church with links there in that downloadable PDF that is the latest edition of the Issues Etc. Journal. 10 minutes left in for your questions or comments about dinosaurs, creation, and the flood. Dr. Joel Heck is our guest, professor of theology at Concordia University, Texas, and author of the book, In the Beginning, God. Dr. Heck, let's talk a little bit about Hell Creek, Montana, and a very recent, relatively speaking, archaeological discovery there. What is it?
Yes, this is the discovery by Dr. Mary Schweitzer of Montana State University. Apparently, this happened sometime in the early 90s, because as far as I'm able to track it, an article about this discovery appeared in Science magazine in 1993. And she cracked open some bones of a Tyrannosaurus rex and put the contents under a microscope and discovered red blood cells. And she also discovered soft tissue, fibrous tissue, blood vessels that could stretch and go back to their original shape. And the odd thing about it is that she says, if you take a blood sample, like today, you take a blood sample today and you stick it on a shelf, you have nothing recognizable in about a week. So why would there be anything left in dinosaurs? End of quote. So in other words, what she's saying, and she herself, though a Christian, is an evolutionist, and she buys into the long ages of the world, of the Earth and the universe. She thinks that the Earth is billions of years old, yet she looks at this evidence that shouldn't be there if dinosaurs have been extinct for at least 65 million years. Really strange to have this kind of a discovery there, and yet she has found it. She's been attacked by evolutionists for coming up with this data, and yet she's an objective scientist. She's describing what she actually found there. In fact, she's been very, very careful in her experimentation. One of the experiments that she did 17 times before she would come to the conclusion that she did. And so we end up with a story here that illustrates the unwillingness on the part of many in the evolutionary community to believe the evidence of their eyes. This has to be the logical conclusion that one should arrive at, is that dinosaurs didn't go extinct tens of millions of years ago, but they are a relatively recent phenomenon, and the whole scenario of the Earth being hundreds of millions, if not billions of years old, is wrong. But it seems as though the direction the evolutionary community is going, because they have closed minds towards this kind of evidence, is to say, well, there must be a way for blood cells to be preserved over tens of millions of years. So they're trying to figure out a way in which that can happen, and it's just not the most logical direction to go based on the evidence that Dr. Mary Schweitzer has discovered.
So at the very least, a discovery like that is left unexplained by the assertion that at some point, tens of millions of years ago, if not hundreds, the dinosaurs went completely extinct.
Yes, it does run counter to the evidence. This Hell Creek, Montana discovery totally contradicts the scenario that dinosaurs went extinct 65 million years ago. She did some studies of how long you can keep things together. The molecules of the material that she put under a microscope, she says the most optimistic predictions had collagen, and she did discover the protein collagen not surviving even 3 million years at freezing point and surviving less than 200,000 years at only 10 degrees centigrade and less than 15,000 years at 20 degrees centigrade. So obviously the higher the temperature, the more quickly something is going to deteriorate. So she did those experiments, and the evidence is that it just doesn't fit with the great age of the Earth or the age at which the dinosaurs are alleged to have gone extinct. So the most natural explanation is that the dinosaurs went extinct much more recently, hundreds or thousands of years ago, or, as I suggested in the first half of our program, that there are some dinosaurs that are even alive today in different parts of remote parts of the world. Maybe not Tyrannosaurus rexes. I mean, those end up growing to be big enough that we would see them sooner or later. We'd be able to discover them in the various land masses, even the remote ones of our globe. But some of the other dinosaurs are probably still around in parts of our world.
Somebody's going to say, look, we've explored the planet pretty thoroughly. If they were there, we would have found them by now. Is there a certain kind of hubris in that statement? I think there have been several points in history where science has declared that we found everything we're going to find. What are your thoughts there?
Yes, a closed mind, a certain amount of hubris or pride that people have. They've got their commitment to Darwinian evolution, and in some cases, not in all cases, maybe not even in most cases, but in some cases, it's necessary to maintain what Philip Johnson calls the myth of the 20th and 21st century Darwinian evolution in order to enable them to be able to hold on to their atheism or their agnosticism. And so they will defend the story of Darwinism, no matter what the evidence that faces them, because they have, and they may not even realize this, but deep down inside, they have to know that things aren't right between them and God. And so ultimately, it becomes a spiritual issue for many evolutionists. If I admit that the earth is young, then I'm probably going to have to admit that there is a God. And if there's a God, then I'm going to have to recognize the fact that my relationship with him is not what it ought to be. I'm participating in certain kinds of behavior that are wrong, and I have to admit that. I have to repent of that. I have to somehow deal with the problem of my sin. And that's for some, and I don't know what percentage, if it's 2% or 80% of evolutionists, but for some, that's a part of the roadblock that gets in the way of them actually looking at the data objectively and allowing the data to lead them in the direction that it naturally goes.
It's part of the issue here, not only that, but the fact that human discovery of dinosaurs in an organized way, an archaeologically organized way, is really a very, very recent scientific lineage, and to draw rock-solid conclusions about their total extinction or the nature of that extinction may be premature.
Yes, I think so. You do wonder about some of the kinds of reporting that occurs, and certainly some people are... There have been hoaxes that have been perpetrated on the American public, the European public. There's a recent hoax that some Chinese alleged to have found Noah's Ark, and then a closer look at the wood showed that there was evidence of a power saw used to cut the wood into the shape that it was to create the beams for the ark, and so they realized that this was a hoax. There have been lots of hoax on the evolutionary side, the Piltdown Man and Java Man, for instance, that were supposed to be transitional forms between apes and humans and turned out to be reconstructed skeletons based upon the jaw of a pig or a tooth of an orangutan or something of that sort. So there have been hoaxes on both sides of it, and Christians do need to be careful and look at the evidence objectively. We don't want to be taken in by something, but we want to look at the data carefully and seriously. And this discovery at Hell Creek, Montana, is one of the more remarkable ones that ought to lead an objective person to look at it and conclude that dinosaurs have existed in the relatively recent past.
Dr. Joel Heck is professor of theology at Concordia University, Texas, and he's authored the book In the Beginning, God. He's going to be one of the speakers at a conference July the 8th through the 10th of Concordia University, Wisconsin, titled The Heavens Declare What Astronomy Can Tell Us About Biblical Creation. With about 20 seconds here, just give us a brief preview of that conference, if you would.
Yes, Dr. Danny Faulkner from Answers in Genesis and Dr. Donald DeYoung both know a good deal about astronomy, and because astronomy and the vast distances of the universe and outer space are one of the major concerns that creationists have, to be able to explain those vast distances and the billions of light years is a difficulty for many Christians. And so we're going to tackle that issue head on at Concordia University, Wisconsin this July 8 to 10. And those two individuals are going to be our keynote speakers addressing those, and will be available for questions and answers. There will be a panel discussion at the end, and there will be some one-on-one time if people want to approach the speakers and ask their own personal specific questions relative to astronomy in particular and its impact on the creation-evolution debate.
Folks, you can check out The Heavens Declare What Astronomy Can Tell Us About Biblical Creation, July the 8th through the 10th of Concordia University, Wisconsin, at our website, issuesetc.org. Click Listen on Demand. Dr. Heck, thank you very much for this series.
Once again, it's my pleasure.
Tomorrow on Issues Etc., we'll talk with Pastor Ben Ball of St. Paul Lutheran Church in Hamel, Illinois, about John chapter 10, 11 through 16, I am the Good Shepherd. Also, we'll discuss the Gospel of Judas. Dr. Craig Evans will be our guest. We'll continue our series with Dr. Alvin Schmidt on the parallels between Muhammad and Joseph Smith, the founder of Islam and the founder of Mormonism, tomorrow on Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. I'll talk with you tomorrow. Thanks for listening to Issues Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Lutheran Public Radio, P.O. Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.
My Peace, a Pentecost sermon preached by Pastor Todd Wilkin.
It will look like suffering, like death, like the worst thing that could ever happen. But Jesus assures them, "It is my peace, and I give it to you."
And for any size donation during the Easter season, we'll send you a CD of this sermon and a sermon preached by Todd on the first Pentecost. You can make a special Easter gift today at issuesetc.org. Thanks for keeping us in mind during the 50 days of Easter.
How would you like to attend a conference and hear Rod Rosenblatt, Will Wheaton, Chris Roseborough, Al Schmidt, Suzanne Venker, and Todd Wilkin? You're invited to the Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference, June 14th and 15th in Collinsville, Illinois. Registration is $100 per person. For more information, visit issuesetc.org. The Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference, June 14th and 15th in Collinsville, Illinois. issuesetc.org.